Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
And a very warm welcome back to Solidarity Breakfast.
A left response to the major developments in capitalism.
What they trade in is not wheat. They trade in famine.
A little dose of revolutionary optimism.
I think it's really important to sort of express solidarity globally.
It really is a deal by corporations for corporations.
The union forever defending our rights. Down with the black leg.
If you think the ABC's left wing, don't listen to this program.
Solidarity Breakfast, 7:30 to 9 a.m. Saturdays, 3CR, 8:55 a.m. Streaming and 3CR digital, podcast or audio on demand. And of course, the website, solidaritybreakfast.org.au.
Solidarity forever!
Good morning, everybody. And we've got a full house this morning. G'day, Anila. How are you?
Pretty good. Very happy to be back.
Yes.
And
yeah,
also very happy
to be
out of bed and not sick anymore. So things are looking good.
Yes. And how are you, Tobias?
Yeah, you're good. Also happy to be out of bed and...
Everybody's been sick.
Yeah, a little bit better.
Yeah,
we got the air purifier on full blast here in the studio.
Yeah, that's right. Radio's fantastic because it's germ-free.
Yeah.
And not only that, it's spring is in the air, I'll have to say. It is chilly outside, but it's blue. The sky is blue, even though it's early in the morning. And we've got lots of things to talk about. You wanted to kick off with the rather egregious legislation that has been passed by
sneakily passed in.
Yeah, I know. It's been ebbing and flowing and I've been watching it. But we appear to have a very, we like to put on a good face to the world, but in actual fact, we've got a dark heart beating.
That's a tough act to follow. That was very poetic. So this week, officially yesterday, the federal government has passed new laws that have expanded the powers of the government to deport people. And the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre spokesperson Elijah Bull has said that, quote, "This legislation is a sweeping attack on the rights of tens of thousands of people simply because of where they were born. It removes basic legal protections for migrants, refugees and people seeking asylum, allowing deportations without notice, without the chance to respond and without fairness." So obviously coming off the back of a week of racist neo-Nazi protests about migration, interesting timing from the government. I think, Toby, you had some thoughts about that.
Yeah, I mean, we were just speaking about germs before and there was plenty on the streets on on Sunday. I'd just like to say that also this legislation that got passed, yeah, like, you know, it hits the low-hanging fruit first, kind of like how policing hits trans people the hardest in the streets. But really, this kind of action can be expected, like, to probably remove political enemies in the future when a Liberal government comes in or when Labor creeps more to the right, these sorts of deportation policies. There's an old 70s movie called Punishment Park, which is, I recommend to anyone, and is eerily reminiscent of stuff like this. But yeah, the March for Australia rally was a bit of a mixed bag. Like, there were people that brought a crocodile on a leash.
What, a real one?
Yeah, walking around the streets of Melbourne to in Queensland, there were people on horses.
What do you mean, Toby? That's a true blue Australian.
Yeah, it was
obviously
just a
real Australians are constantly bringing crocodiles everywhere.
And I think the weirdest thing is like seeing how no two groups of people in these rallies were actually united on an idea of why they were there. There was an undercurrent of naivety, like, I've seen a lot of footage from all the way around Australia. Like, yeah, there's an absolute core of heinous racism brought about by, I don't know, social conditions and just lack of education and then just probably straight out actual ignorance. But there were people that were saying, oh, it's nice to be Australian because if people want to assimilate, they need to like meat pies and they need to watch the footy. Do you know, it was just like very bizarre. But the one thing that can be said about almost every rally, that happened all around Australia was that they were completely co-opted by Nazis. None more so than Melbourne and Sydney.
It's interesting that you say co-opted, because I think there's a strong argument to be made that they were organised by Nazis.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, more in the sense of that people went in there, whatever, and maybe didn't do their research or anything, mm-hmm. and captured. They were captured.
Well, my theory on this, and I've been thinking about it all the way through the week, is that the mainstream media, the legacy media, didn't miss a beat, and we're taking the ABC as well. They immediately, it's almost like they'd already got their headlines prepared before they started. It was all about migration, all about migration, all about migration, when in actual fact, it's not about migration. All evidence proves that migration in Australia is not the cause of the cost of housing, the cost of living crisis, the lack of jobs, or lack of services. None of that's true. So if that's true, if that's provably not true, then why is it that every time we come to any position like this, like what's going to happen, what's happening right at this moment that required the foot soldiers of the extreme right and the big end of town to go onto the streets and then to do a public relations campaign, which it was, because what you do is you set up an agenda, you set a fuse, then you keep talking about it, keep talking about it, keep talking about it. And that's what a publicity campaign is. That's what it is. It's what a public relations firm would advise someone with an agenda to do.
And you're absolutely spot on, because at every rally there was the same PR techniques, there was the same chants used, there was the same uniforms, the same taking up stage time to varying effects. Obviously, the most effective ones were Melbourne and Sydney, where the Nazis were either welcomed on stage, like in Sydney, when they were clapped through the ranks, or in Melbourne, where they were told by the organizer that they, as long as they didn't mention Hitler, they'd be sweet. And that would be a direct quote from Beck Freedom, who organized the rally. In Brisbane, they crashed the stage when they were told by the organisers they weren't welcome to be part, and still managed to harass an Indian migrant. But their chants were not actually to stop mass immigration, which was... It was a weird statement, because even when we talked to March for Australia people down here, it seemed like it was pretty mixed messaging. So we said, I made this joke that our friend's dog was actually a migrant because we're all Italian. And so to not touch the dog because it was a migrant and you don't know what it's got on it. And they said, oh, well, he's Italian, he's fine. So this conception of what migration is and what mass migration is and what all these things are kind of hard to pin down. But the Nazis' chants were really easy to pin down, because they weren't about mass migration. Their chants were send them home. They're about mass deportation. That's what their chants were. Met with actually quite a lot of support in most cities, whether people wanted to admit it or not. Even the more naive people, their chants of the Skyhook song, Will I Ever See Your Face Again, they replaced it to Will I Ever See Your Race Again.
Oh, my God.
Oh, no, it was Living End, not Skyhook's Living End.
Yeah.
And Living End put out a statement saying, we're deeply shocked that they used our song.
Yeah.
How dare you do this?
And
they were really mortified.
Yeah. So the mass deportation stuff, and so far as to even one of the speakers, a libertarian politician, was advocating that our forefathers laid it clear that the white Australia policy should be the way forward.
The thieves and murderers said that this country is for white people after we kill everybody else.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's interesting that you guys bring up the concept of whiteness, and I think it's. Yeah. I mean, even the point about, you know, Italians, you're fine. Obviously, a few decades ago, Italians wouldn't have been considered white. And I think it illustrates the fragility of this concept of Australianness, but also whiteness as this kind of...
what is this whiteness
like
business?
It's not culturally specific. It's just in opposition to anything that isn't white.
Yeah.
And I think, it's scary thinking about the way... it's not surprising, but scary thinking about the way that whiteness... directly in opposition to non-white people is still such a formative part of Australian identities.
Well, it's interesting. It's almost like to be an Australian, you have to be a racist. But the other thing is that if you do a bit of reading, it's interesting, the whole business about whiteness, because whiteness came into the human genome quite late, actually. We all actually come from African roots. So, of course, and then it was much later, much, much later, that there was a strain that focused on, brought out a white coloration. But, you know, it reminds me of, it's like sexism, you know, the idea that men are the template because, you know, like we have the Bible story that it was Adam and then Eve came out of the rib of Adam. But in actual fact, the template is female and it's the men that are then... shaped out of the template of femaleness.
Don't tell the Andrew Tate bros. You have them running scared.
But I think it's also worth pointing out.
It's funny though, isn't it?
I think it's all about people kind of understanding their identities in opposition to other people. I think that's why there's a bit of a similarity between how masculinity is constructed and how whiteness is constructed. But I think it's also worth pointing out that... the idea of whiteness isn't really to do with biology at all. It's very intimately tied with the history of colonization and
that's
developing
right.
an argument for why it was appropriate to into non-white populations and exploit
and
people
them.
And the land and kill them.
And kill them,
And it's happening we've right now in Palestine.
Yeah, we need a cover story.
The real effects of white supremacism. And it's funny, biology is brought out now and twisted to being the new kind of phrenology and weird science by places like Israel to justify what it's doing.
Mm-hmm. It's quite bizarre. And I want to rein this in because they keep talking about the, part of the fear is that there's not enough to go around. There's not enough to go around. But, of course, if you were really worried about resources in Australia, you would be worried about fracking in the Northern Territory because it's water we should be worried about. You should be worried about what's going on the Barker with this. And also, as Arahu, the renters and housing union, says, it's not a housing problem we've got. It's a hoarding problem. And one of the most disgraceful elements headlines came out that children are dying as unaccompanied homeless children fall through support gaps. New data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare has for the first time revealed the scale of children experiencing homelessness without a parent or guardian and highlighted serious gaps in support. So the statistics that came out recently, 13,300 unaccompanied children aged 12 to 17 sought out specialist homelessness services in 23 to 24. Of those children, 2,443 were aged 12 to 14, 96 were alone, 6% were in a grouping of children, and 63% were female. Tragically, 3 in 4 unaccompanied children, that's 70% who were homeless when support started, were still homeless when support ended in 2023 to 24. And then it goes on to talk about how hundreds of those children over the last decade have died. They've died. They've just disappeared off the face of the earth because they have no home.
And it's a real war on children. Sorry, Anila, sorry to jump
okay.
in.
No worries.
With the amount of child removals from First Nations communities in this country, people should be...
horrified.
But people should be called to action from what happened on the streets this week. Showed a real lack of taking this problem seriously, the problem of fascism in this country and the problem of white supremacy and the response to it. The liberal response to say, oh, stay home and have a butter chicken to be a proper ally to immigrants and da-da-da, whatever, or don't engage with the protest at all, actually engage. And it doesn't mean you have to...
Well, sitting on the fence is a political statement.
Yeah, and it doesn't mean that you have to punch on, but every extra person that's at a counter protest or every extra body that's there gives you safety in numbers. So there was the real threat was women. Women were targeted at every point in at these especially in Melbourne. I'm speaking, we were trying to do as much reporting as we could on the day, and when the Nazis came into contact with the rally on Collins Street, they came into contact with a protest whose marshals couldn't do anything to mitigate this threat, which there was a police line that was non-existent, where was a police line was maybe there was 40, 50 people to every 40, 50 police, sorry, they're not people, to every one protester. When there was trans people counter-protesting the rally or Palestinian supporters counter-protesting the rally. But then when the actual Nazis at the front of the March for Australia rally were in a direct line of sight to the Palestine protest, there was no police there. And when they did attack, there was two women made unconscious, one getting absolutely thrown to the ground. And then later that day, when the Nazis stormed Camp Sovereignty, they attacked almost exclusively women, leaving one in needing stitches to her head. And so First Nations people have called for a rally in solidarity next week on the 13th. So everyone make sure to come out. And then Camp Sovereignty have called...
What date and where is it?
13th at the State Library, I believe.
And what's the time?
Midday. I'm actually not sure of that one. I'll just get the details up. But also today at 12 p.m. at Camp Sovereignty till 10:30, there'll be a whole day. They're calling it the Sovereign Day Out. At Camp Sovereignty.
A family day.
A family day, a snap action in response to the attack on Camp Sovereignty by a neo-Nazi group, a day of celebration of multicultural so-called Australia and a stand against fascism. The day will comprise of live music, workshops, stalls, food, speakers and dance performances. There'll be the Terries, Soju Gang, Miss Kanina, Becca Hatch, Kian Kian, Birds, Moju and a whole bunch more.
I think I wanted to take it back to, Annie, what you were talking about in terms of resources and how resources are distributed in our community is such a central part of why these problems are cropping up. So not just homelessness, but also people being completely oblivious to the role that migrants are playing in propping up our economy and... you know, the fact that without migrant intake in Australia, we are not...
We're an ageing population.
Yeah, we're not at replacement levels.
We're not at replacement and levels. They've just got to look at the statistics.
One of the things that I find...
We're stealing the young people from other people's countries.
But one of the things that I find so kind of, I guess, distressing about these acts of really blatant racism and dehumanisation of people who aren't white is that... Australia's economy is propped up by people who aren't white that are being exploited for the sake of the majority white population.
Yeah, yeah.
And Oxfam recently released a report about slave and child labour in Bangladesh. And I think this is a perfect illustration of the way that Australia's economy is deeply intertwined with the exploitation of migrants in Australia, so black and brown people in Australia, but also people in the global south, black and brown people in the global south. So Oxfam, in their report, found evidence of widespread and systemic labour rights violations, including widespread exploitation and child labour across Bangladesh's garment supply chain. The report has implications for Australian fashion brands that source clothing from Bangladesh. The report found that, quote, forced labour was self-reported by 28% of workers, while 95% of factory workers surveyed are paid below a living wage, rising to 100% among women.
Oh, my God.
And so I think... Yeah, a perfect illustration of the way that the fact that the average Australian has access to a house and clothing and food and all of those kind of basic and also beyond the basics and necessities of life, lots of luxuries that people across the world do not have access to. The fact that people have access to those resources is explicitly dependent on the relationship between white Australians and black and brown migrant Australians and people in overseas countries who are being exploited so that you can wear fast fashion.
You're on Solidarity Breakfast with Tobiah, Annie and Anila.
The Black Lives Matter movement is not going away here or overseas. It gives me hope seeing the numbers of people that turn out to these Invasion Day demonstrations in Melbourne. It gives me the understanding that we will win, folks. We will succeed.
You're listening to Radical Radio on 3CR, 855 on your AM dial, 3CR digital, and podcasting and streaming on 3cr.org.au.
Traditional custodians of the land in where I live, I laugh and I grieve. The Dharawal Nation. I want to say that we stand together in joint struggle for liberation for all oppressed people, Indigenous all over the world. From Gadigal to Gaza, long live Palestine, treaty now, land back. My name is Safar Ayan and I am a proud Palestinian woman. My father comes from a town called Barbara, which was annexed in 1948. Barbara was a small coastal village where people farmed grapes, which I only found out recently. In 1948, my grandfather took my grandmother and my father and my auntie Rivka to the Jabalia refugee camp, which has now been completely annexed. Yay! On October 30th, 2023, my siblings and I were all in our homes, and it was around 10 o'clock at night, and we were all watching Al Jazeera. That night would have been one of the most horrific nights that we ever lived through, because we watched my father's home on the news across the other side of the world bombed. And we watched as my aunties and my cousins were walking out of our house, which was a relief. But it was also completely consuming because now they were homeless. But it didn't stop there, because in November 2023, we got news that my auntie Rivka, who was dispossessed in 1948, her home was demolished by a Maccabi tank in the Shatet refugee camp along the beaches of Gaza, which Jared Kushner and Donald Trump want to make the Riviera of the Middle East. And this is why I am here today. I am here to tell you about a company that is complicit in this genocide, a company that is creating those Maccabi tanks which are dispossessing my family, which are making my aunties and uncles and my cousins homeless, a company where I live called Bisalloy. But in January 2024, I actually met Wollongong Friends of Palestine. And I went from feeling helpless to actually feeling hopeful. Shout out to my people. Maccabi tanks that roll into those goddamn GHF sites with the machine guns mounted on the top, which are shooting to kill Palestinians who are starving. Yeah. And Bisalloy also sell their armoured steel to Plasan Sansa, who supply armoured vehicles to the settler militias across the West Bank end of 1948. It is the quenched and tempered armor quality steel that allows these vehicles to be mounted with machine guns to be strong enough to plow through homes, shops and olive groves. These vehicles kill Palestinians regularly. It's just an hour from here, but it is 15 minutes away from where I live. Why am I telling you this today? Because you see this energy that we have here today. Sydney, you come out. And what I want from you, Sydney, is I want you on the 21st of September to bring this energy to Bisalloy. It's actually a really lovely space when the employees don't try and get into their workspace, because we camp overnight at this Roy. We did it a few weeks ago. We had live music and we had food. Food, not bombs. Where are my food, not bombs people? They come out. But picketing at Bisaloy means working together to physically cut the genocide supply chain that links our hometown with the Zionist entity. We have closed Bisaloy down 7 times. We want to close them down, not just overnight, but for a whole 48 hours. And we need you, Sydney, to come stand with us. We need you and your numbers to come help us close that shit down. We need to make it so they cannot profit off our blood. We need Bisaloy to know that participating in genocide is going to bankrupt them, not make them billions of dollars. And before I end, I want to say, Bisaloy, you can't hide. You're complicit in genocide. Come out to Union Durham on the 21st of September at 8 p.m. to help us shut them down.
Another trap is the way that the mainstream media and politicians insist that Palestinians seem to be innocent before they can be warned. This destructive narrative enables genocide in so many ways. It's what legitimizes the death of so many journalists, medical workers, men, women and children, killed because of allegations they were Hamas, or even just in the same vicinity as Hamas. As Muhammad al-Kirk argues in his recent book, Perfect Victims, we need to stop buying into this narrative. Instead of engaging with endless propaganda about whether this or that journalist had an association with Hamas, we need to take the power of those lies away by saying, so what? Even if the journalists worked for Hamas, they're not a target. Even if the Hamas fighter was in the hospital or school, that hospital or school is not a target. Israel's actions have gone beyond illegal occupation and unlawful invasion to genocide. Israel must get out of Gaza now. Full stop. There are no legitimate targets for Israel in Gaza, let alone non-combatants. Apply anything else puts a target on the back of the next man, woman or child that Israel starves or kills.
You're with Annie and Tobiah and Anila on Solidarity Breakfast, and that was a piece from the Sydney Rally for Palestine put together by it was recorded by Vivian Langford, our wonderful compatriot from the Climate Action Show, which is on at 5 p.m. on a Mondays. And you had something to say because you actually edited together a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. I mean, also endless love for Vivian, because it's been over a year now of the staunchest correspondent, Sydney correspondent.
Yeah, fantastic work.
Absolutely, all our love out to her. But that last piece from the last little snippet, this Nikolai Haddad speaking, and he said he has a very salient point where he says you have to push back on the narrative that it was a Hamas journalist or it was a Hamas this. Because irregardless of whether a medic was part of a political organization or not, still not a target.
No, it, still not a target, thank you very much.
Even if there was a, you know, so-called Hamas doctor or something, whatever that
even means. What a ridiculous notion.
It still doesn't mean that a hospital can be bombed, and it doesn't make any of these things a legitimate target, and that actually people should free themselves from this sort of framing, because it's what legitimizes Israel's war crimes.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Servi dei, servi dei, servi dei. Our final speaker is Steph Price. Steph is with a tenants' rights lawyer, is a tenants' rights lawyer, it's not past tense yet, and a public housing defence activist, also a executive member of the Victorian Socialists. She in fact ran for the president state seat for the Victorian Socialists. So Steph.
This fight's been going for a long time, and I want to acknowledge to start with this. This is probably the biggest turnout that we've ever had for public housing in Victoria, certainly at the start of the rally. So that's exciting, and we need to build from here. I don't live in public housing. I didn't grow up in public housing. I didn't raise my children in public housing, and I didn't find safety and security for the very first time in public housing, like so many here today did. Like generations of Victorians, generations of Australians have. I'm not here today fighting for my home. So many are. They're fighting for their homes, their communities, resisting by rejecting the government's lies. Lies that community and public housing are the same. An absolute lie. Resisting by rejecting the lie that this government has suddenly discovered its care and concern for residents of the flats, for their living conditions and their comfort. This government has found its concern for residents of the flats exactly the time it wants to wash its hands of them, when it wants to break up their communities, clear out everyone who has made a home there, and hand these estates to developers. Huge swaths of inner city land, estates that right now are islands. Islands in a housing hellscape. Islands where the only question you need answer to live there is, do you need a home? An island in a sea of market-based, profit-driven housing failure, where the government is right now spending $600 million fixing the fact that for years Victorian developers were cladding high-rise new builds in cheap combustible cladding. They wrapped residential high-rise towers in highly flammable material, and in the UK 70 people burned to death because of that. Our government is spending $600 million to fix that disastrous failure of the developers, the very developers that they want to hand these estates to. And if you, like I, wondered how many public housing units you can build for $600 million, the answer is 2,000. We reject the lie that the government has found its care and concern for the residents of the flats. Where is the concern when residents ask for basic maintenance? Homes Victoria can and has mobilised an absolute army to door knock the estates. Over and over, and we've heard about it today, over and over, they are everywhere on the estates, forcing people to sign relocation agreements that they don't want to, they don't understand, that are full of lies. Call the housing call centre. There's no army, there's no nothing. And still we fight, because public housing is worth fighting for, because theirs is a deliberate strategy, tried and true. Starve an asset of resources, watch it decline and decay and declare it unsalvageable. And still we fight because public housing is worth fighting for. We know, because we know that of all the special things about public housing, the least special thing are the buildings. Important though they are, there's nothing unique about these buildings. They are bricks, mortar, concrete and plaster. They are not the only buildings in Victoria, the absolute only buildings in Victoria that cannot be repaired or retrofit, and they would have us believe that. No, this is a deliberate strategy to find a justification to push public housing out of our city. We fight because we all have a stake in public housing. I have not made my home in public housing, but I stand in solidarity with public housing residents who are fighting for their homes. And I encourage everyone to respond to the call when it is made to stand between the wrecking ball and the towers. But this is not only a call for solidarity for those bearing the brunt of this attack. We are fighting for something that belongs to all of us. We might not all make our home in public housing, but everyone has a stake in this fight. We all have a stake in resisting the idea that nowhere can be free of the market. Not one housing estate, not one inch of our lives, not one childcare centre, not one aged care facility, not one disability service We all have an interest in the fight against every single one of our basic human needs being an opportunity to profit.
Yes.
We all have an interest in protecting those very ordinary bricks and concrete because of the homes that people have made there and because of everything those flats represent. The government knows what those flats represent. They are beacons standing in direct opposition to Australian capitalism's voracious hunger for profit from the commodification of every human's need to find shelter every night and every day. These flats are a slap in the face to the developers, to the banks, to the landlords that think every inch of our city is theirs. These flats are a slap in the face to governments who want nothing more than for us all to forget that there was a time when government accepted that it had a direct obligation to provide housing, that housing is a right. Yep. They know that as long as those flats stand, that memory stays alive. And for all of the reasons that they want those flats gone, we have to fight to ensure that those flats stay.
Free CR Community Radio, giving voice to the community since 1976.
And that was Steph Price, and she was speaking at the August 2nd rally to save public housing in Victoria, which is another crime up against governments.
And before that, we heard one of my favourite songs. We've been playing as many different versions as we can on the Radio Philef thing. That's called Rigurgito Antifascista, so it's like vomit-inducing reflux when you see fascists in the streets, a really famous Italian song.
And we've got Dylan on the line from Community Lawyers. G'day, Dylan. How are you?
Good morning. I'm good. How are you?
Good. And the reason for why we've got you on the line is because you're going to be part of an action on the 10th of September to stop work for Palestine.
Yeah, that's right.
Tell us about why you think it's important for people to involve themselves in this.
Yeah, no worries. Well, let me just start by introducing myself a little bit. So I'm an Australian Services Union delegate, and I have been for the last 7 years at a variety of different workplaces, including my current workplace. So I'm a lawyer at a community legal centre in Melbourne. So I'm also part of ASU Palestine and broadly and broader in the Union for Palestine. So, you know, I think all listeners would already know that over the last 2 years, the genocide in Gaza and the continued occupation and violence in the West Bank has only worsened to an unspeakable level of catastrophe today. We are standing up and taking to the streets because of the failed leadership of our government, our bosses, our workplaces, and to some extent the failure of unions as well, who have been largely unwilling to make any more than two-sided statements about Palestine. So we've called for a strike on Wednesday, the 10th of September. So that's at the State Library. That's been organised by Union Palestine. We're asking for all workers to join us to walk out of their jobs and take a stand against silence and repression.
Actually, it's in stark contrast to the response of dock workers across Europe who have said that if the flotilla isn't allowed to get through to the to Gaza, then they will shut Europe down. I mean, stopping at 1 o'clock on the 10th of September and going to the State Library to be part of a rally is a small ask, isn't it, when the genocide is occurring?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, looking to Italy, it's incredible to see what kind of power workers and unions can exert in order to take an anti-war stance, an anti-genocide stance. And, I mean, there's been examples throughout Australian history where workers have taken strike action for political or anti-war campaigns. I mean, there's a tendency there throughout history where workers can take a stand and have an incredible impact. And you know, we know that enough union and worker power can have the ability to shut down Australian industry and the economy in the name of Palestinian solidarity. But, you know,
I was just going to say that it's not a vain chant when they say we're all Palestinians, because this affects all people of all types. They could do this to anybody, what they're doing to people in Palestine.
Yes, and that's why, you know, we have an obligation, I think, to do as much as we possibly can to say no more, and that we're not going to stand for this to happen in our name. And that's why we need to, you know, push back against growing repression and silence in Australia for anyone that takes a pro-Palestinian stance.
So Dylan, if workers out there want to be to do this, what's your suggestion about how they should go about it?
So as I mentioned, there is a strike that's from 1 p.m. on Wednesday. That's the strike part, like walking out of work. But there's also we're encouraging all workers to participate. To participate in any way they possibly can. There's also a rally, the rally component at 1 p.m. at the State Library. So whether or not you take the afternoon off, take sick leave, annual leave, or just come down on your lunch break, the rally is a takeaway of joining us, showing solidarity with the strikers. It's been endorsed by the ASU, the NTU, Free Palestine Melbourne, and the Free Palestine Coalition NAM. So there's quite a bit of momentum building. So we would encourage anyone to come down and show what support they have.
Yeah,
they
and can. Bring people. Yeah, and bring absolutely. As many people as you can. And it's funny that the ASU and NTU, well, I mean, in an ironic way, is that these unions that usually get pushed around for being like white collar academics, do nothings, they're the ones that have been doing the most for Palestine, and will do the most on Wednesday as well, coming.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose there's a lot of agitation from the rank and file to get their unions, I guess the bureaucracy of the unions to take a stance. So that's what we're seeing, that the ASU and the NTU are putting their, you know, support behind the rally component, not the strike component, but the rally that's happening at the State Library.
Thanks for talking to us this morning, Dylan.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
A week solidarity brekkie team listener, when we saw women protecting the camp sovereignty sacred fire violently attack a gang of black-attired neo-Nazis. Just when we thought the giant minds and courageous men in black may have attacked them, but no. Their leader, Thomas Sewer, assured us they were simply protecting themselves, putting them in the category of the "she hit my fist with her jaw, she kicked my boots with her ribs" category, and Tom's lovely little moustache, I just can't think who it reminds me of. Or to be grammatically correct, of whom it reminds me. Due to this bloody awful cold I've had, I missed Sunday's events, but watching footage and photos, it seemed the coppers were just as disgusted with the National Socialists, because they couldn't even bear to face them, facing the anti-fascists instead, replete with capsicum spray and the usual arsenal of paramilitary weaponry. Because we know the constabulary would have no time for neo-Nazism. Still, the giant and courageous minds in black would have been cheering by week's end as the socialists and the coalition got together to pack no proper papers, queue-jumping illegal boat people off to a small, impoverished island, which will teach them for having the gall to flee poverty and persecution. The socialists and coalition running their usual dead heat in the who-can-be-more-cruel stakes. Better to spend a fortune to frank your heartless credentials than allow desperate people to enjoy the refuge they seek and contribute to the country they hoped might show them some compassion. Still, the brave fascist victims of those violent camp sovereignty women mightn't be 100% happy if some of those banished to Nauru are, wait for it, white. In the depends which side you're on department, the mainstream media and the caring business class, hayseed and sheepshit coalition parties are outraged that former state supremo Dan Anscrews the Workers socialised with a bunch of autocrats, expressed delightfully and objectively as only the Lord Rupert of Wapping Sin can. Victorian Ukrainians disgusted as traitor Anscrews the Workers joins tyrants, including warmonger Vladimir Putin at military parade in China, then screaming P1, Dictator Dan and the Despots. And sure, they're a fine bunch. They seem to miss that delightful Belarus supremo who rigs elections and persecutes any opposition who was there in all his glory, but be that as it may, Dan mixing with wanted war criminal Vlad does seem to get a slightly different response than when Dan mixes with his very, very, very close friend and another wanted war criminal, Zion Supremo Benjamin, not another Yahoo. That leads to the same lots praising Dan, turning the argument, taking the opportunity to rail against those who declare Benjamin a war criminal. And of course, the outrage to cry the unelected autocrats, knowing the path to great leaders is the democratic election process, throwing up inspiring examples like Donald Trample the Poor and our very own Anthony Albing Uzi. On such matters, since there seems to be a bit of a difference in the coverage of, say, police being murdered and non-police being murdered by police and on deaths in custody. Not that they are murders, because no one is ever charged after an unbiased investigation into themselves by themselves. Meanwhile, our Minister for Being Offensive and Train Killing, Richard Malls the Bad Guys, he of the giant mind, headed for the US of the UN of the US of the world, on the off chance he might run into someone who would talk to him, ready to return with his usual brown tongue, and what luck. The US Ops Secretary for Being Offensive and Train Killing announced they had had a happenstance meeting, meaning presumably he ran into Richard wandering around aimlessly and hopefully. Richard hoping someone might just line up a meeting between their big supremo Donald Trample the Poor and our very own Anthony. Alas, poor Richard, another failure. Donald offered the slaughtered, destructed, genocided, starved, non-land, non-people an offer they can't refuse. A few mirrors and beads and piss off and leave your real estate opportunity to real estate opportunists like Donald. In a treacherous lack of appreciation, the non-land, non-people didn't seem all that impressed by the generosity. Ingrates. Already years behind in reaching our 2030 renewables target, or more correctly, spot on to reach our pollution target, as we approve more and more coal and coal and coal and gas and gas and gas to facilitate the transition from coal and gas, Energy Approval Minister Chris Bowen, the Capital, has hit upon an inspired plan for our mid-30s target we're obliged to announce under the Paris Agreement, which in turn has proved such a roaring success in controlling pollution, addressing climate change, if there is such a thing. Adopt a flexible target, a range of possibilities in the knowledge there's no way we're going to get there anyway. Brilliance offset slightly by these interfering bloody climate scientists who think they know more than Chris and the responsible big polluters, who reckon Chris's moving target just maybe shouldn't rely quite as much on offsets, on, say, planting a tree at the back of Bali, allowing you to pollute to your heart's content. Science to the fore in Western Troubler, Aussie, where they've just approved a, quote, green iron project using potent greenhouse methane. Green. Well, the WA Environment Pollution Authority said, yes, because if the iron was processed in Asia, it would use coal. Perhaps they need to understand that the green in potent greenhouse gas doesn't make it green. But these long-haired commie greeny wouldn't work at an iron, pesky, annoying, anti-progress environmentalists can be so cruel. Take that Bob Brown. Big Supremo Anthony Albanese's hand-picked minister to do over the environment, Murray Swatch the environment's perfidious job, he raved, is to sacrifice the nation's natural heritage to satisfy the blinkered big end of town. Have we heard anything so cruel? Not only an insult to Murray, but to Anthony and to the responsible polluters. Blinkered big end of town? Come on, Bob. They know exactly what they're doing. On the environment, in the credit where credit's due department, top marks to rubbishy corporate lead away your money, which modestly tells us all it does for the environment, primarily the environment of its bottom line. It so cares that we recall a couple of years ago it was done for unsafe trucks, unsafe for its drivers, the workers it so cares about, and for the environment as they became a toxic waste redistribution service, leaking their contents as they went along. Oh, and done also for rigged scales at dumping sites, which, surprise, surprise, worked in its favour. Well, this week, more exciting news. Supremo Mark Schubert, real name, lost 30% of his bonus just because there had been three workplace deaths and a leap in serious injuries of those workers it so cares about. That's about $500,000 the poor man's lost, or roughly 160 grand per death, or even less if we add all the serious injuries, leaving Mark to battle on with a mere slightly less than 2 million as a bonus, of course, not his reasonable little salary. Only a touch, well, several hundred touches more than the workers who were killed and injured, but no doubt the caring clean away your board would have passed a resolution to send their condolences to the loved ones. Carried. Right, next item, bonuses. But the credit where credit's due bit, clean away your knot only kills and injures workers, but for years the affected community has been fighting to have the Tullamarine toxic waste dump near the airport cleaned up. Little matters like toxic waste leaching into the waterways and finding their way into the bay, and toxic fumes emanating from the site with claims of high cancer incidence in the environs. But after years and years and years, Clean Away Your keeps avoiding its responsibilities, earning responsible executives like Mark huge bonuses. See, credit where credit's due. It treats its workers it so cares about and the community it so cares about exactly the same. Notice the High Court threw out poor Ben Roberts, despite the innocent attempt to appeal against being found a war criminal, a bully, a disgrace to the uniform in that defamation case we bet he wishes he'd never launched. All rights exhausted, Ben said. He accepted the decision. Well, we're not sure, Ben, if he had any other options. Although in his defence, that disgrace to the uniform bit, that's their job, to kill people. In that case, at least someone's rotting in a jail cell, the whistleblower who allowed the war crimes to be exposed. Unlike RoboDebt, the government copping up an extra $550 million compensation this week, bringing the cost of the public purse thus far to $2.1 billion, and a measurable damage, a measurable cost to the victims. Yet not one scummo minister nor public servant responsible for the disaster has faced justice. And wonder if a war criminal will ever be charged. In the week that was bad sport sport, as regular AFL revelations confirm homophobia is definitely not dead in the men's game, the Brain Dead of the Week award to those Adelaide fans Thursday night who booed Collingwood's Isaac Quayner all night. I wasn't aware till then that Quayner was the target of that homophobic slur that saw an Adelaide star suspended, and the crowd blamed the victim. In men's AFL, homophobia is far from dead. That was the week that was Bad Sports Sport Report. The Caring Employer of the Week Award. This is always a tough one. There's so many worthy contenders, but this week a romp for the AN0FU Bank, planning to sack or, sadly having to let go hundreds of staff. It's all about efficiency, apparently, and how did the staff find out they were for the chop? Accidentally. Someone pressed the wrong button, and an automated email told shock workers to hand in their company computers. We're sorry, the caring employer sorried. This is not how we intended this to go, and, it said, it doesn't show how we think of our people. Of course not. They really care. Why they were forced to provide dedicated psychologists for the somewhat shattered accidental recipients. Not how we treat our people. Don't they mean our ex-people? And finally, we'd have to think surely, sadly having to let them go is a somewhat bigger clue as to what they really think of them and how they treat them. There's got to be better ways to throw the workers you so care about onto the unemployed scrap heap, like not throwing them there at all. Good morning.
And thank you very much for Kevin. And
the much requested Kevin.
Kevin, that's right. So the listener out there that rang up and wanted to know if it was he was actually going to be on, there you go. He had a cold last week. It was nothing to do with being pulled because he was too radical. No. It was because he was sick.
We wouldn't do that to Kevin.
Oh, no. And we know that you're only listening because Kevin's on. And on the line, we've got Don Sutherland. G'day, Don. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Annie, and good day to everybody listening in and also to whoever's joining you there in the studio.
Yeah, Tobiah and Anila are here, and we're all talking profits, aren't we? Where do the profits go?
Yeah, where do the profits go? I thought we should continue this discussion in the light of the previous ones we've been having about the economic reform roundtable and productivity and all that sort of stuff.
I think that's a fair call.
So I want to discuss this pretty recent, in the last 15 years or so, escalation of a business investment practice called share buybacks. And the reason for that is that because it is becoming so prominent, it is replacing, up to a point, productive investment. And it poses the question, well, what are the major corporations doing with their profits?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there's a whole lot of discussion about productivity, and most people think that that relates to workers and machines doing creating more wealth. But in actual fact, there's other methods for around productivity, isn't it, for the big end of town? They're not that interested in that. They're just interested in profits.
Exactly. Well, they are interested in some level of productive investment. They have to be in order to survive. But what is going on is a shift in the composition of what is done with profits from productive investment to a pretty, at times, dramatic increase in this practice called share buybacks. So perhaps very quickly, what is a share buyback? In brief, it is a practice where the board of directors or the principal owners of the company authorise or directly engage in buying back shares owned by other investors, usually at a premium price. The effect is that those shares get taken off the market, and that has the effect of increasing the value of the remaining shares on the market. Now, that is measured in a thing called earnings per share, and that's really important to attract ongoing buying of shares in the future. The essence of it is that this practice is very different to spending the proportion of profits on the productive improvement of the company, which is often what workers are looking for themselves, because they are getting more and more frustrated with the aging of the equipment and machinery and the factories, etc., that they have to work in. So it is nothing to do with productivity improvement.
And, I mean, actually, it seems like it's completely in opposition to productivity improvement, as you're kind of hinting to. Can you... I think the RBA, the Reserve Bank of Australia, has been talking about one of the causes of the decline in productivity being the concentration of wealth in certain parts of the economy. Can you tell us a little bit more about how share buyback programs directly contribute to that concentration of wealth?
Yes, well, there's... you can actually, of course, with all the search engines available these days, you can actually... get a deeper dive into all of that. But there are four case studies going around that you could directly refer to. The expansion of share buyback practices is quite significant, including by just about all of the corporate executives who were at the economic reform roundtable. I've got to emphasise the impact. Share buyback investments, as they are, put that in inverted commas, replaces not just productive investment, but the capacity for research and development, and also for skills formation of the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
And it does require a drive down in wages and conditions, and the shift of investment away from the transition to renewables. So the four case studies illustrate those things in various ways. The two case studies that illustrate the damage done by share buybacks to environmental regeneration, the struggle against climate change, are Woodside Energy, who was represented at the ERR, and the Macquarie Group, who were also at the ERR. Now, in both of those cases, although in slightly different ways, share buybacks have been a big deal in returning short-term significant wealth gain for the minority of big shareholders, while also protecting the, if you like, the financial position of the ordinary shareholders, the less dominant, if you like.
Well, you pointed out that the Macquarie Bank people got themselves into hot water, didn't they?
Yes, well, the Macquarie Group one, the Woodside Energy, quickly on the Woodside Energy one, The share buybacks in Woods, practiced by Woodside Energy have directly reduced and slowed down their level of investment in serious green transition.
Wow.
In the case of the Macquarie Group, it's a slight... by the way, in Woodside, there's been no significant fight back against that direction.
Yeah, within the investor group.
In the Macquarie Group, it's different. Now, Macquarie Group, at the core of it, it's an investment banking manager. It's a bank that manages investments, particularly by big investors. Now, the case there is different. They have also been big time into share buybacks, often directly for themselves, but also on behalf of big investors who put their investment capacity into the hands of the bank. Now, in this case, the opposition to the share buyback program, the unproductive program, has come from big institutional investors who think climate change is an urgent problem and serious, and particularly industry superannuation funds. So industry superannuation funds were at the heart of a recent annual general meeting of Macquarie Bank, in which they carried or sought to carry a resolution disciplining the board for their encouragement and supervision of very, in some cases, somewhat dodgy share buyback activity by their staff.
Oh, now, wow. That's cheeky, isn't it?
Well, the distinctive feature of that board is, of course, that the chair of the board is one Glenn Stevens, who was the prior governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. And the CEO is Shemara Wikramanayake, who is a bit of a darling in the capitalist world and was also an active participant at the Economic Reform Roundtable. So what it is called in investor language, it's called a first strike against the remuneration report, a statutory requirement for corporations. And they have to clean up their act if that is carried. Now, they didn't get a majority, but they've got enough of a vote for it to be regarded as a statutory, in inverted commas, first strike. It's not a strike in an industrial sense. It's a
No. It's more like a strike across their bowels.
So there you have probably the most powerful private investment bank in Australia, whereas board supervises a practice that is against the productive development of the economy.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
I think, sorry to cut you off, Don, but I think it's an interesting segue to thinking about what kind of role are these corporations being positioned to play in the energy transition? As you've just pointed out, they're not really contributing to the energy transition.
No, they're just lining their pockets.
But it's funny you bring up Glenn Stevens, because he was on the record this week saying that basically they're aligning their position on the environment with the federal government, and he said, quote, Macquarie is going to be part of the transition. Macquarie is involved in that. So I think the Labor government and, for instance, Glenn Stevens...
What, are they the same people who just opened more coal mines?
Yes, exactly. Well, that's what I think it's really interesting, because the Labor government is regularly reiterating the important role of the private sector in the energy transition and in environmental reforms. Banks have clearly picked up this rhetoric and have started using it as an excuse to avoid accountability for their contributions to climate change.
So they're doing a dance routine, but behind the scenes they're actually just business as usual.
Yes, exactly. But I think I would love to hear, Don, from you about why it is that Labor policy keeps on emphasising the role of private investment, even though these companies, as you've just talked about, are clearly not interested in contributing to climate reform.
Well, they are marginally interested, actually, but not in a decisive manner. And the answer to the clue to what Stevens was on about and what you were driving at is found in a statement from the Business Council of Australia that coordinates these major corporations, particularly in lobbying the government, where they claim that for the government to adopt the low-end 60% reduction in greenhouse gas emissions by 2025, a decision they're about to announce, that's relative to 2005, to get to 60% reduction in greenhouse gases, the Business Council says that $400 billion would need to be invested. And they go on to say that that requires an extra 59,000 workers in electrical and engineering trades by 2030. They are going on then to say that that is a very big impost, a very big ask, a very onerous load on private capital owners. Ultimately, they want to persuade the government that the public should pick up the slack.
Per usual.
That means pressure on the social wage. That is what the majority get back in terms of social services of various types relative to the taxes paid. So this is what is going on and is the subtext of what was happening at the Economic Reform Reform Roundtable. It plays out also from the point of view of workers. The other two case studies in the longer and longer list of companies that you can look at are Qantas and DP World. Those case studies are really useful because they show how the share buyback practice both requires but also establishes the outcome from driving down wages and conditions of workers. In the case of Qantas, you could spend a whole program talking about how evil the Qantas board is, starting way back under Alan Joyce's leadership. But the current average life of their aircraft is about 13 or 14 years. Some say it's higher, notwithstanding that under the new board they're actually investing in new ones. That all coincides with significant malpractice of industrial relations, shown recently, of course, in the decisions about the outsourcing of ground staff in 2019 to avoid proper enterprise bargaining, and which has resulted in, I think, a $90 million fine announced not long ago by the High Court.
And I think it's also worth pointing out that Qantas engineers, who are responsible for one of the best track records in aviation globally, are some of the worst paid engineers. And these are not necessarily the types of roles that you don't want to be paying properly, people who are responsible for the safety of people at takeoff and landing.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, spot on. And right now, they are the focal point for industrial disputation developing in Qantas. And that is the requirement for Qantas to be playing really hard ball is in order to make the workers pay for their share buyback program. The distinctive feature of the Qantas practice was that they borrowed heavily to fund their share buyback program. Mm. It still worked financially for the biggest shareholder, worked very successfully, which is why Alan Joyce is still so popular with them.
Oh, my God.
Now, the interesting thing about it is that because they've used a loan arrangement to fund their program, I'm not sure when they've done that for every single one of their share buybacks, but it has had an impact. That intensifies the requirement to make the workers pay for it.
God, the corporations, Australian corporations, are laggards, it would appear.
Well, they're not laggards. Qantas cannot be described as a laggard when it comes to delivering shareholder value, profits, if you like, to a sufficient profit that delivers shareholder value, especially for the medium-sized and biggest shareholders.
But for all of us?
For working people, of course, we see the intensification of this contradiction between the interests of working people, and this is a precise case study of the intensification of exploitation relative to profit taking.
It's literally how they managed to take a bigger piece of the pie.
In the last 15 years, it's become a practice that has enabled them to do exactly that and at the same time dodge responsibility for whatever problem there is with productivity.
You know, it just leads you to say, why should we be listening to what they have to say? They are just so self-interested. We have to finish there because... So have you got anything that you want to sort of round off with?
Well, three very quick points.
Hurry up.
One, another case study is DP World, which is the focal point for industrial disputation on the waterfront with the MUA. Second point is that the corporate participants in the roundtable can best be described as rogue. And we have to get it in our heads that we've got to stop respecting them, except for the extent that we respect how they exercise power to make life tougher for the majority of the people and worse for the environment.
Yeah.
Is that we must improve our own capacity to come up with an alternative program that enables general democratic control over the investment decision. The notion that is prominent in our union movement, that this is not the union business, is nonsense. We must get over it. This is a big deal because it impacts so much on our ability to win wages and conditions struggles and health and safety struggles, let alone bigger issues even than that.
Oh, thank you very much for talking to us today. You've given us lots to think about, Don.
Thank you very much. Great to have some time with you and look forward to the next time.
Good on you, mate. And that's the end of Solidarity Breakfast this morning. You'll be going off to the event at Camp Sovereignty later in the day, 12 p.m.
There's a lot to go out to, 12 p.m. At Camp Sovereignty. No alcohol, drugs. It's a family event. You can bring your donations there and help support Camp Sovereignty as they build a campaign. Also, the Eco-Socialism Conference at Balham Place. Lots of speakers, lots of Marxist speakers from all around the world today and tomorrow, organised by Socialist Alliance and the Green Left. Also coming in the week, obviously, on the 10th, there's the strike and the protest at the State Library at 1. On Thursday night, Philip will be organising in conjunction with 3CR Chairperson Pilar for the remembrance of the September 11th attacks in Chile. There'll be a screening of a new documentary called Mother Country at Democritus at 6:30 p.m., 583 High Street, Northcote. And also on Friday, we'll be doing BDS Community Skillshare Workshop that everyone's welcome to. Bring your ideas and we can start to do something that's beyond panel discussions to get some practical solutions. That's also at 6:30 at Democritus, 583 High Street.
And if you'd like to support refugees and migrants in the wake of the recent deportation bill, the Asylum Seekers Resource Centre is encouraging people to check out their website for more information about the bill and how to email your MP to express your outrage.
And that's it. It's a wrap. And coming up next is Asia Pacific Currents, and we'll go out with Bugs.
Well, I have a reason, I know why. Don't do it just so they'll die. If you're gonna kill a bug, don't do it just because. I like bugs, and I'll tell you why. They're alive, and so am I. Bugs. I like grasshoppers, cause frogs eat them. I like bees, cause flowers need them. I like spiders. I like slugs, I like caterpillars, I like bugs. I hate crowds, I love people. I ain't down with the plague, but I'm cool with beetles and bugs. Whoa, bugs pretty cute, bugs pretty fun. There's a couple of bugs I try to stay away from. Mosquitoes, ticks, business flies, bugs in suits, bugs and ties. And I get bit and it makes me itch. You ain't never gonna hear me complain, cause a bug bite never really kills me. I just get bit and I itch and I go on my way. Galler's bird. Alright, you made it. Tenacious dung beetles pushing their gains. Little water beetles riding a wave. Butterflies are beautiful and moths are mysterious. We study fruit flies for genetics if you want to talk serious. You know, by and large, bugs are okay. They're just doing bug things, going about their bug day, uh-huh. And I don't know what the mantis is praying for, but it probably just thinks...
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.